Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. Well, whoever came up with that term, no rest for the weary, knew something about the news cycle and also a little bit about the season of life that we're all in right before the elections, because there's not going to be a lot of rest for the weary. And there's certainly a plethora of really big news stories that we're going to be covering today. And quite frankly, really for the rest of the year, we shouldn't just say through Election Day, because the reality is that we're in this sort of news cycle together right now that is just going to constantly be distributing unexpected news. We got a lot of it over the last week in the shadow of the debate. And now we're in, again, this period of time where the tension continues to rise. I was listening to a couple different political analysts. You know, I like to skip around. I'll listen to a podcast that's more progressive. I'll listen to a conservative commentator. And I like to sort of collect all of this information, sort of like a collage, and then think about, well, what's actually the most interesting thing to pull out for you? Here's one of kind of an interesting observation by Ryan Priebus, who was at one time worked with former President Trump and worked with the Republican Party more specifically. He was doing an interview on ABC this weekend. It was a panel conversation.
At this very moment, both campaigns are taking $1 billion and they're focusing in on about 500,000 people that will actually decide the election. And those 500,000 people take in about 5 minutes of news per week. And so it may not matter whether what's said in a debate, what happens, you know, in regard to pets.
Almost 70 million.
There's so few people at this moment. You take Wisconsin, it's 48-48. There's hardly anything left in the middle that's undecided. People are hardened.
Okay, think about that. Because what he's talking about is just how slim the margin is for victory and defeat. And when you look at it, when you look at it kind of across the different swing states and you sort of count them up, count up the different undecided voters that are out there, carry the one, divide by whatever, you know, you eventually get to just a few hundred thousand voters that everyone wants to convince to vote for them. And it's not just voting for them, it's showing up. It's doing the work to get the vote across the finish line. And as the tension rises to get to those voters, you're going to start to see different themes really pulled out by campaigns, because they're kind of really thinking about what is the research telling us about what's resonating with people and how do we get that one person that we need to stand up, make a move, and actually vote for us, actually become tethered to this process. That just stunned me. The amount of money that's really not for everybody, it's for these specific voters and convincing them to come over to one side or the other. So that sort of also helps put in perspective why we see certain themes being repeated by political campaigns. They're trying to do it for a reason, for strategic reasons. And what's difficult is that can start driving news cycles rather than actual news, like new information. Because we're trying to cover the campaigns and what they're doing, because that is newsworthy, but it's not necessarily like high value news, like the things that are happening in our communities that are also impacting the story in which we're living right now. I thought this was a good way to start off our broadcast today, though, something that brings us together. And I read this quote earlier this morning, and quite frankly, I wasn't watching the Emmys. Does anyone watch the award shows? Are we into the award shows anymore? I do love the fashion still. I'll go through those slideshows of all the different dresses. That's my guilty pleasure, you know, looking through some of that. But as far as these award shows, you know, the Academy Awards, I mean, I don't know. I used to watch them a lot, and now I kind of find myself missing them and not realizing it. And so last night there were the Emmys, and obviously there's some comments, political comments that were made, or different actors, actresses winning awards, different shows. But this comment came from someone I don't know too well, the co-creator of the winner of the best comedy series, which is Hacks Best Comedy Series. And Lucia Anello is her name. And while she was accepting the award for Best Comedy Series, Lucia said this, when you laugh with someone, you have something in common with them. And I thought, what a cool way of understanding why comedy matters. When you laugh with someone, you have something in common with them. I thought, yeah, that's it. It's true. You just are sharing kind of this moment, this light moment together, whatever the joke is. And isn't that a moment where, you know, you start building friendships or kind of cuts the tension in the room, brings everybody together? When you laugh with someone, you have something in common with them. So I love that comment and just wanted to share it with you. It's sometimes hard to keep our sense of humor when the news can be heavy. And we're going to move to some heavy news next. So just think about that when you're having a laugh with a friend or a colleague or something along the line over the next couple of weeks. So let's just talk about the big news of the day. Late Sunday, we get this breaking news that there was what's described as an apparent assassination attempt of former President Trump. When this news broke on Sunday afternoon, the immediate thought, at least for me looking at this breaking news, was, again, what is this about? Is this real? It was almost the same as the last process of, is this real? What does this mean? What are we talking about? Where's the information? And the information was a little bit slow coming, completely different situation than what we dealt with back in July. And so let me just set the stage. It's a Sunday. We have former President Trump off the campaign trail. He is golfing in a familiar area, familiar course close to his home in Florida. And apparently during this game, there was someone or something suspicious spotted. And as we learned from the Secret Service, and I'll play a little sound for you in just a moment, it's very common practice that the Secret Service, when President Trump is playing golf, that he's playing, let's say, on one particular hole, and the Secret Service, some of them are going to move ahead of him and look at the next hole and make sure that's secure, maybe move ahead. And they're moving in these kind of circles together. So there's those that are protecting him in and of the moment, but those that are looking ahead down the course. And it was during this looking ahead period for a Secret Service agent, we don't know who at this time, that there was a rifle, some sort of gun that was spotted. And we don't know exactly how this part transpired, but we know that the Secret Service agent fired in the direction of this gun, or perhaps they saw the individual. We don't really know. That individual flees, takes off. There's a good Samaritan that takes a photo of this car. Eventually, they track down this person and they arrest him. What's still unclear at this time is whether or not there were any shots exchanged. We do know that the security shot in the direction of this particular person, but we don't know if there was a shot fired in the direction of former President Trump. So why are we using this term apparent assassination attempt? It's a little bit because of that. There's an investigation ongoing, and while it seems that it would be very clear and almost editorial to call it an apparent assassination attempt, because if you have the former president playing at a golf course where there's security and you have someone that looks to be set up taking with the intent to take aim at the former president, shouldn't we just say this is an assassination attempt? Well, typically, at least for Smarter News, what we do is we do follow law enforcement. When in doubt, we're going to follow the direct quote from law enforcement because we also think that's going to tell us something. And in this particular case, it did tell us something because the investigation seems very active and very ongoing. The suspect who is in custody now is facing charges. There were initial charges that this suspect faced in court today. And these charges are related to federal gun charges. So they're not related to, let's say, attempted murder, attempted manslaughter. There's no language like that yet. What this tells us is we're going to watch. We're going to watch for that language because these are the initial charges. It doesn't mean this is all that this person is going to be charged with, but the initial charges don't have to do with an attempted assassination per se. They have to do with federal gun charges. What we know about this individual is he has a long rap sheet. And in fact, let me read you a little bit of his background. This is according to NPR, which had some of the latest information. I just pulled this up. I was looking for who had the most recent published date, and this is NPR. So this suspect, apparently his criminal record dates back decades. And I'm just going to read through this a little bit. I'm not going to use the name of the shooter. Typically, we don't do that. I don't think it's also particularly newsworthy right now. I think what's most important to get an idea of this person. So records from the North Carolina Department of Adult Correction reveal his long history of trouble with the law, including a 2002 conviction on a felony charge of possessing a weapon of mass destruction. I did hear some reports this morning that this would relate to, we don't know specifically, but well, let me go on and read because there's a little bit more here. A December 2002 story in the Greensboro News and Record recounts an incident in which he was pulled over during a traffic stop on a Sunday night. He, quote, put his hand on a firearm and drove to his roofing business where he barricaded himself inside for 3 hours. The weapons of mass destruction charge pertain to a fully automatic machine gun, it reported. So it is not legal in America to own a fully automatic machine gun. That's number one. It's also not legal to own a gun after you're convicted of a felony. And so this individual was convicted of a felony. There's a series of other charges that he's faced, misdemeanors and felonies between 2001 and 2010, including a hit and run offense, carrying a concealed weapon, possessing stolen goods. I think you get it. This person has had trouble with the law before. He's not allowed to own a weapon, but he was arrested with a weapon just over the last 24 hours. So that's where the gun charge is coming from. And there's also, let me see if I can pull up the exact language. The language was a possession of a firearm with an obliterated serial number. So that's something else. Your firearm has to have a serial number on it and you can't like scratch it off. Part of that is to understand gun ownership, all of that under who's tracking gun ownership, what that looks like. That can be very controversial, but guns have a serial number and you can't scratch them off because then who does the gun belong to is hard to trace. One of the reasons. So this person's being held on these gun charges. You will continue to see the language apparent assassination attempts because that is what law enforcement is using and that's what most of the media is using now. You can have your own kind of opinion of what was going to transpire here. We'll see what the investigation actually turns up and that will be notable. So now you know, if you see a change of language, note that. If you see there's additional charges, note that. We expect a press conference later this afternoon. And until that time, we don't have a bunch more information. I do want to play a little bit from the press conference late yesterday, just so you can hear some of how law enforcement was talking about this themselves at the time. And I think there was some good information in this about 45 seconds. So let's take a listen.
Because the bubble moves through the golf course. So our agents will get there first, clear it. He noticed that the rifle was pointing out, our agents engaged. We are not sure right now if the individual was able to take a shot at our agents, but for sure our agents were able to engage with the
suspect.
I don't know that.
Doesn't appear so.
Is it
in
their
home?
Yep.
How far away was the president? How far away was Donald Trump when this gentleman was caught and stopped?
Probably between 300 and 500 yards, but with a rifle and a scope like that, that's not a long distance.
Barbara was asking a great question in the chat, which is, you know, why would the Secret Service agent shoot and not engage? You know, that would be an interesting question to get a little bit more perspective on exactly how this transpired, but I'm sure it happened very quickly. And the timing matters. Here we are almost 2 months to the day, 2 months to the day since the attempted assassination that clearly took place in Pennsylvania. So we don't exactly know the scenario, you know, where exactly, how did this all happen? Why would you shoot? Why would you not run? How does this, these are parts of this investigation that we don't know right now. It is notable that, remember, we have a new acting Secret Service director because of the security or perhaps lack thereof at the event in Philadelphia. So this is now under, this event happened under a new acting Secret Service director. And the president made some comments on this just again over the last 24 hours where he said he felt that the Secret Service was under-resourced and that Congress needed to provide more resources for the Secret Service. In this press conference yesterday, there was made mention that if former President Trump was the president, the security posture would be different. But because he's not, they're providing security as he's moving rather than locking down an entire area. So, for example, locking down the entire golf course and creating an entire security perimeter versus a perimeter that's moving with the former president. So there's more to unpack here. And that's basically what we know at this time. Let's just also acknowledge, though, how scary these headlines are. And we don't ever want to be in a scenario where we're acknowledging yet another attempted assassination. So we want to learn more about this suspect. We want to know about motivation, plans. What do we know about this individual? He seems, according to reports, to have been politically active and at one time vote Republican, another time vote Democrat, and one time perhaps support former President Trump, another time perhaps not. And so we'll get more of a profile of this individual. It did make me think back about how little we still know about the attempted assassination in Pennsylvania, how there's still a lot of questions about that crime. And because the individual is dead, we don't have those questions being answered as part of an active investigation in that particular way. Certainly there's an investigation still ongoing, but the why, whether or not there were other people involved, there's questions about this event. So we still don't have a lot of answers there. And for this particular person, we know that he can actually answer if he so chooses to provide a little bit more context. One of the things that stands out to me, and I'm going out on a limb here because we're still sifting through this information, is what stands out to me looking at these two stories, the attempted assassination back in July, and then we have this apparent assassination attempt that's happening in September. If you look at the profile that has so far been reported, you're looking at two individuals that seem to have been politically homeless. At one point, affiliating with one side, then affiliating with the other, and how that moves from someone then trying to take action, if that's indeed what the case is here, makes me just wonder about all sorts of things, from our political environment to the media environment. And obviously there can be a lot of different blame to go around, but we're going to have to wait, and we're going to have to, fortunately and unfortunately, have a little patience. The Secret Service agent that was on site said it very blatantly. He said, "We live in dangerous times. We live in dangerous times." So we'll wait and watch for more information on additional charges, any change of security posture around the former president, around Vice President Harris. And we're just going to have to go with the news as it comes. And that's where we sit today. In the meantime, I want to switch to some other political news, but also news that's really related to your quality of life, and that's the economy. There were a lot of questions about the economy on last week's debate, which, by the way, seems like a million years ago, but it was just last week. And we're going to get some news on the economy this week that I just want to flag for you. We had some questions about this as well. There's been all these questions about whether or not our borrowing rates will change. Right now, we know the central bank, or the Federal Reserve, we use his terms interchangeably, has kept borrowing rates high as a way to try to temper inflation. The thinking behind that is if borrowing rates are higher, we slow the economy down. It's like tap, 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 tap on your brake in the car. Try to get the economy to slow down, because inflation is essentially the economy overheating. There's a supply and a demand issue. There's an issue with pricing. And inflation is where our dollar buys you less. Higher inflation means your dollar buys you less. So we don't want high inflation. We want some inflation because that reflects a growing economy. You know, things cost more now than they did when our parents were young. That's part of the economy growing and evolving. But we don't want it so high that our dollar doesn't buy us anything. And we don't want it so high that it's starting to create an issue with the economy that is more systemic and greater, so that we can't break out of it. We want a healthy balance to our economy. There has been some recent signs to show that the rate of inflation, not necessarily the prices that you're seeing, but the rate of inflation has come down. And for this reason, the expectation this week is that the Federal Reserve will lower rates. They can see an opportunity to do that, to try to stop tapping on that brake so much and kind of let off it, let everybody coast a little bit and bring the borrowing rates down. This federal funds rate, that is what they control, is not directly associated with everything that you would borrow. You know, it's not directly, that federal funds rate directly affects home equity lines of credit, or directly affects certain things, and tangentially affects other borrowing rates. So the bottom line is, if you see this week that the Federal Reserve is lowering rates, that mostly will mean that borrowing costs will come down across the board or start to. If for some reason the Federal Reserve decides not to do this, that would be really big news because the stock market and investors have basically baked this in, anticipating this, anticipating the optimism that could come from this. So it's something to be aware of. It's also important to know that we want to watch what's said. Could this be the start of rates coming down where we could see other meetings where rates come down before the end of the year? And that could be really helpful as you're planning your life and kind of figuring out when you want to borrow money and what that could look like. So it's not just watching the headline, which are the rates, but also watching what's said about the U.S. economy and what's expected. And if for some reason the Federal Reserve comes out with some really, you know, pessimistic news about rates going down further, we could see a certain reaction in the stock market. And we just have to remember when we see news and a reaction in the stock market, that's fine, but we're going to give it a couple of days to smooth out and see really what's this all about. So that's something I want you to be aware of. Also, this just wanted to take a moment on this. I saw an interview that happened after last week's debate that I thought you would find really interesting. So there was a portion in the debate last week where former President Trump and Kamala Harris, Vice President Kamala Harris, were talking about the economy. I'm going to play a chunk for you so you could hear it. And then what I want to show you on the other side is a different perspective that will perhaps enlighten what both are saying about their plans. So take a listen to this.
So Donald Trump has no plan for you. And when you look at his economic plan, it's all about tax breaks for the richest people. I am offering what I describe as an opportunity economy. And the best economists in our country, if not the world, have reviewed our relative plans for the future of America. What Goldman Sachs has said is that Donald Trump's plan would make the economy worse. Mine would strengthen the economy. What the Wharton School has said is Donald Trump's plan would actually explode the deficit. 16 Nobel laureates have described his economic plan as something that would increase inflation and by the middle of next year would invite a recession. You just have to look at where we are and where we stand on the issues. And I'd invite you to know that Donald Trump actually has no plan for you because he is more interested in defending himself than he is in looking out for you.
I went to the Wharton School of Finance, and many of those professors, the top professors, think my plan is a brilliant plan. It's a great plan. It's a plan that's going to bring up our worth, our value as a country. It's going to make people want to be able to go and work and create jobs and create a lot of good, solid money for our country. And just to finish off, she doesn't have a plan. She copied Biden's plan, and it's like four sentences. Like run, spot, run, four sentences that are just, oh, we'll try and lower taxes. She doesn't have a plan. Take a look at her plan. She doesn't have a plan.
Okay. First of all, one issue that we've talked about for both Democrats and Republicans right now in this campaign, for both campaigns, is really describing the how. We've gotten a lot of headlines of how, of ideas, but how is it going to be different if we reelect former President Trump for a second term, or elect Vice President Harris for her first term, but her second administration in the White House? Like, how are these administrations going to look different and produce different results for the American people? Bottom line is, that's a question that we need to have answered. I did look at the school, Wharton School, because I was curious if they did an assessment of these different economic plans and found out there's actually a really good resource on it. It's quite complicated. I found it right before we got on the show. So I'm just going to give you the headlines, but I'll include it in the notes in case you want to look into it. And it ties into the soundbite that I want to play for you as well. So the Wharton School of Business put together, you know, a look at the different candidates' policy proposals. And here's what they found. This is just a headline. They estimate that the Harris campaign tax and spending proposals would increase primary deficits by $1.2 trillion over the next 10 years. Goes on to say, lower and middle income households generally benefit from increased transfers and credits on a conventional basis. This is some of the language that's used. But bottom line is lower and middle income households generally benefit better than higher income households, according to this plan. So they're saying her plan increases deficits by over $1 trillion. If we go down to their assessment of former President Trump, they say that his plan would increase primary deficits more than $5 trillion, $5.8 trillion over the next 10 years. And then they also said, though, that households across all income groups will benefit on a conventional basis. So how are they using these different metrics? That's in their assessment here. But I thought what stood out to me is that both of these different proposals, according to the Wharton School, will actually increase our deficit. Courtney asked a great question on our chat. She said, do you have any interviews about the economy? I don't really understand how we got here, and I'm tired of the blame game. It seems a much bigger reason than just he or she did this. It's a great point, Courtney. And one of the things that both parties share is an overspending issue. So our debt, and I can show it to you, we have a national debt clock that is constantly running. So if you ever want to give yourself anxiety, this is a good way to do it. You can just go to usdebtclock.org and you will be able to see it. Let me go ahead and share it with you so you can see what I'm looking at as well. And it'll show us just how much the debt is going up. This is a spending issue. You know, both sides will blame each other for the spending issue. But if you look at our national debt, I mean, trillions of dollars, 35. I mean, it's constantly going up. These numbers are so big, I don't even know how to explain them. So while you could say the Wharton School of Business shows that Kamala Harris's plan increases the deficit by just over $1 trillion, former President Trump over $5 trillion, we're still talking about really, really big numbers. And this is why this caught my attention, because Goldman Sachs was referenced by Vice President Harris. There was an interview done by CNBC with the Goldman Sachs CEO. And what he said about both of these plans, I thought you would find interesting.
Some politics debate was last night. Not sure if you had a chance to see it or not. Your own economic team, of course, has made news of late, suggesting that the bigger boost to growth would come from the Harris economic plan, at least over the first couple of years. She mentioned it last night. You feel the same?
So that report, which was mentioned last night in the debate, came from an independent analyst. And it's interesting, Scott. I think a lot more has been made of this than should be. What the report did is it looked at a handful of policy issues that have been put out by both sides, and it tried to model their impact on GDP growth. And the reason I say a bigger deal has been made of it is what it showed is the difference between the sets of policies that they put forward was about 0.2%. Okay, so economy grows, okay, if you took these particular sets of policies they looked at, and by the way, we have no idea whether these policies, these things that are talked about will ultimately be implemented, what was the growth impact? And the differential was 0.2%. So, you know, I think our clients are trying to look at what's going on from a policy perspective and make judgments. I think this blew up into something that's bigger than what it was intended to be.
You said in August, though, I'm going to quote here, we need a set of policy decisions that help us deal with the trajectory of spending, the level of debt, and the cost of that debt. Whose policies fit that?
Well, I think one of the interesting things, I did watch the debate last night, and just one of the interesting things, and I could be wrong about this, but this is my recollection of what I watched. Did the debt come up once in the conversation all night? I don't think there was any discussion about the debt, you know, at all in the debate last night. I do think this is a policy issue that's going to have to be wrestled with, but I didn't hear any discussion about it last night.
Fascinating. Fascinating, right? So totally different perspective. Goldman Sachs is an investment bank. It tried to have more of a commercial branch, sort of like Bank of America. You know, I can walk into Bank of America or walk into Chase, JP Morgan Chase Bank, but I can't walk into Goldman Sachs Bank. So it is a different type of banking. I think it's important to mention that as well, because there's a different perspective. But here we are trying to parse through like a lot of different plans. We're like, well, this person said we'll wear green on Tuesday, and this person said we'll wear green on Wednesday, and they're actually not that different. Like, these campaigns are trying so hard to say we're so different than the other person. But when you look at, for example, some analysis from Goldman Sachs, it shows the difference is almost negligible. It doesn't mean it's not important. And it doesn't mean there's not a philosophical difference as well that can resonate with voters in a different way. But how fascinating that some analysis is like, well, not that different. not that different. So we're going to, you know, I always like to look at that perspective too. Okay, we have one assessment from the Wharton School. Well, what about this from Goldman Sachs? Okay, well, what's the truth? We'd have to see these policies in place in a particular environment, because policy ideas are fine. You can assess them for the environment that you expect. But let's say there is a global pandemic, and then that the way that that policy plays out is totally different in reality. So we got to be careful with this stuff. And maybe it's more of a value play. How do both of these candidates speak about the economy, speak about what they, how they want to create value for you and what that looks like? And it's really the story that they're telling, that they're inviting you to be part of. Do you like the story that former President Trump is telling about the economy now and the future? Do you like the story that Vice President Harris is telling about the economy now or in the future? Which resonates with you? Which makes the most sense? Sometimes digging into the details, you know, just gets us deeper and doesn't actually give us the perspective that we maybe need. Martha asked a great question, and it's a follow-up to the debate about what's going on in Springfield, Ohio. And just want everyone to know, I did do a podcast in the 24 hours after the debate, where I spent about half that podcast digging into, well, what do we know about Springfield, Ohio? What about these claims of those that are in the community from Haiti that are hurting or harming pets? Like, what is this all about? I did a deeper dive on that. So it's available for you to check out, and I'll make sure that that's in the show notes if you missed it. This continues to be an issue of conversation, in part because it's something that no one was talking about a couple weeks ago. And although both sides have wanted, in some respects, the Republicans more so than the Democrats, to talk about the border, you know, nothing has really broken through. So this is a story, a community of people that has seen a drastically different dynamic demographically because of an influx of Haitians. And Haitians are coming in because of a protected status that's granted by the U.S. government. It's not full out asylum, but they have permission to stay in the country as they have this protected status because Haiti is essentially a fallen state. You know, gangs have taken over Haiti. And so these people are fleeing a situation. They don't have refugee status. They're not granted asylum. They have it's a very specific status that can be granted by the U.S. government. What I do want to show you, though, is that we do have some ways of looking at, and this just could be something that could be helpful to you. Let me see if I could pull it up here. As you kind of think through this story, and I'm going to make this bigger, of like, who's actually coming into the country? Well, there's data that's publicly available that shows this to you on a month-by-month basis. And we're waiting to see what do these last 2 months, August and September, look like when it comes to border encounters. So what I'm looking at right now is nationwide encounters. These are the numbers that different political sides will take and use to their own benefit, but these are the numbers that are on record. Who did Border Patrol encounter? So these are not everybody that came across our borders, but the ones that law enforcement actually saw and interacted with. And you can see, so we're looking at 2024. We're looking at this orange line. This orange line has declined compared to where it was last year, where it rose in the final half of the year where we were charting this. Part of the reason Customs and Border Protection says for this decline is because we have a change of policy, an executive action by President Biden to discourage people from coming across the border without legal status and attempting to apply for asylum. Essentially, if I came across the border illegally and I say to Border Patrol, well, I'm here to apply for asylum, I can no longer do that. And in fact, I can be turned away and told I can't do it for another couple of years because I broke a law coming into the country. This has been challenged in court. And so we're kind of waiting to see of whether or not this executive action can stay. We know things are stronger if they're passed through legislation through Congress, but this was an action taken by the Biden administration. If you go up to these different pull-down menus, you can actually see who people are coming into the country. Are they coming from Ukraine? Are they coming from Russia? Are they coming from Haiti? So we can actually click on Haiti and we can apply this to the graph and you can see, well, what happened last year? Last year, we had a huge rise in people coming from Haiti. We went from, let's say, 5,000 people coming in July of 2022 to 17,000 Haitians coming this July. And so this shows a change of dynamics at the border. We see this orange line showing the folks that are coming in or encountered from Haiti. Not all of these people were allowed to stay, but it is worth pointing out that if they have temporary protected status by the government, the likelihood is that they were allowed to stay, even if they came in the country without legal status, even if they came across the border illegally. So that gives you an idea. We can kind of, you could kind of pull down and you could start seeing, you know, I'm going to go ahead and let's just check out Russia and Ukraine. You can do both at the same time. And you can see here that we had a kind of a big spike in 2022. And then it sort of has leveled out over the last 2 years. So it's an interesting tool that's available to the public. I just thought I would point out to you. And the reason why I'm doing this is what I've seen over the weekend with news gathering, the vice presidential candidate, Senator J.D. Vance, who represents Ohio, Springfield, Ohio, is a story that's all centering around, was on all of the big shows. He obviously had a press availability and said to the press, hey, anyone who wants to talk to me about this, like, I'm willing to talk. And by the way, if you're a journalist, you take that interview because he's a vice presidential candidate. You want that time. And it was a very contentious interviews with the press about this topic where he says, listen, I know you sitting in New York or DC can't substantiate these claims of behavior that's happening in these communities, but my constituents are telling me this. And while we can't verify everything that people are saying, we are, there's a broader picture here about immigration and border enforcement that we need to talk about. The press is mostly pushing back and saying, yes, but you are spreading, this is their allegation, and I'm generalizing here, these claims that are unsubstantiated that the mayor of this particular city says isn't true, that law enforcement in the city says isn't true. And J.D. Vance would come back and say, yes, but I'm being told this by my constituents. In reporting, that's very difficult to square those two things. And it's better just to state for the audience, okay, the local officials are saying there's no evidence of this. They haven't encountered this. They haven't seen it themselves. There's constituents or someone that's saying that they have heard or seen, and then you quote that person. Right now, it's just going round and round and round. The bigger story here is immigration. It is a question of different communities changing and whether or not certain policies have led to that change. This is something that J.D. Vance is trying to talk about while also inserting his own kind of gathering of information from the area. And he's kind of going back and forth with the press on it. So there's tension between that. You know, I'd love to go to Springfield, Ohio. If anyone has a contact there, I think you have to see it for yourself to understand what's happening in this community. It was a community of just over 50,000 people. And over the last couple of years, an estimate between 12 and 15,000, according to city officials, Haitians have come into the area. And they weren't bused in. They weren't placed there. It was an area where there were jobs and the community started to grow. So it's a very fascinating story where there's a lot of different angles. One of the things I mentioned in our report last week is, you know, you have those that are concerned about their community that are on the record speaking about that at city meetings. This is partly how this viral moment started about whether or not people were taking animals out of the parks or pets or any of this. This is people stepping to the microphone in community meetings that were recorded and then became viral moments. And then you have people that are business owners that say, listen, our area was really decimated. We didn't have workers. And now we have workers that are helping the area. So there's a lot to this story. And I would just hesitate on trying to drill down and say, well, this is the one thing that is true. I think there's many things that we can take from this story. It's one example of changing dynamics in America. It's one example of a community. There's many different sides to it. Yes, there's these allegations or, you know, rumors that, or reports. We can use a lot of different words about how people are behaving in the community. And all I can say to you is we have what we have on the record and what a sitting senator is saying. That's what we got so far. And we'll see how the story develops. We expect that we will get new border numbers probably over the next week. And that data will be shown in the same data set that I showed you. And that will also be interesting. Do we continue to see a decline in encounters? Is it because of this executive action? And how does that change the conversation about what's happening at the border and how big of an issue both sides want to make it? So hopefully that's a little bit of help. Just want to touch on two really quick international stories that I just want you to have on your radar. We're not going to go too far. Just want to show this to you real quick. So South China Sea, There's been all sorts of attention on the South China Sea, and I want to show you where it is. The South China Sea here is actually in this in the particular map, you can see it. It's right in the middle here between the Philippines and Vietnam, and you have China to the north. Even though it's called the South China Sea, that doesn't mean that it belongs to China, though China believes that it does. And there's been an increasing tensions in this particular area where the Philippines and the Philippines Coast Guard is trying to protect what they say is their land or their territory. And what they also are saying is international waters. International waters are sort of agreed upon globally, and we want international waters to be protected because it allows the free flow of trade. If it's just one of the reasons. If we say a certain country owns a particular waterway and cuts off that waterway from the rest of the world, it could have really drastic impact. So America and others has been focused on making sure that the South China Sea, despite its name, stays open as China has become more protective of certain islands in this area and says, this is ours. What we've seen is this continued aggression between the Philippines and China. We've seen boats being rammed. Things that we have not seen before. There's been tensions and close calls. And we sometimes see, our ships sail through certain areas and the Chinese vessels carefully watching us. And there's like that the perception of a lot of tension, but now we're seeing actual boats colliding. What we know this week is that Germany is sending ships to this particular area, sending it to the Philippines for the first time, the German Navy, in 20 years. So it's another sign that there's a lot of countries watching the dynamics here. And I don't want us caught off guard if there's a larger incident that could take place. We're also watching this particular area because Taiwan is not directly in this part of the South China Sea that we're talking about off the coast of the Philippines. But Taiwan, you know, is the major maker of semiconductor chips, which power almost everything that we use. Taiwan claims its independence from China. China does not agree with that. And there's always that question about China wanting to take back Taiwan. So as we're moving towards the election, there's ways that international incidents can become bigger, where there can be different calculations made by superpowers because, well, we want to get some attention during the election cycle, or we feel that people are distracted, so we're going to make some moves here. And the fact that Germany sent over their ships to this area when they haven't done it in decades made us stand up and take notice. Holly McKay was doing a little reporting on this, and we have more of it on our website. So wanted to make sure you have a heads up about that. The next thing I want to talk to you about is Venezuela. And I'm showing you a map of Venezuela because it's easy for us to think, well, Venezuela is South America. It's so far away. Venezuela is a 3-hour flight from Miami. So it depending on where you live, like it could be easier for you to get to Venezuela than it can be for you to get to California. And a shorter period of time. Venezuela as a country we know is overtaken by a dictatorship. And there was recently a quote unquote election where the current person in power, Maduro, has maintained his power, Nicolas Maduro. But there's been all sorts of challenges to whether or not that was a fair election. And many world leaders say it is not. The person that was challenging him has now escaped essentially to Spain and is there. Continues to speak about these issues, but Venezuela remains in turmoil. And there's been a great deal of crackdown on anyone that's coming out and speaking against the government there. So there's a lot of turmoil. What is a new twist to the story is over the weekend and over the last couple of days, there's been reports that there's been a certain arrest of U.S. citizens in Venezuela. One, according to the U.S. State Department and a spokesperson talking to ABC, they confirmed it was a member of the U.S. military. There's also some reports that there's additional Americans that have been arrested related to this first arrest of this military member. We don't know who that is. And I'm waiting for a State Department presser today, if they have one, to, or even from the Pentagon, to learn a little bit more. The Venezuelan government is accusing the United States of trying to foment turmoil inside Venezuela and perhaps even try to overthrow the government. This is a complaint by many of the regimes out there that we do not agree with, that accuse the United States of meddling and wanting regime change in different countries. There are U.S. Analysts that also think that's been a broader part of U.S. policy in the past and disagree with it. So where this story goes, I'm not sure. But it's another place to watch because Venezuela has really close connections with Iran, close connections with Russia. They're not too far from us. Oh, and by the way, they have the largest known oil reserves in the world. So the possibility and potential for Venezuela to be an active member of the global economy in a way where it is engaged by world powers is there, at least economically. It's not there as far as who's in power. And there's a lot of stuff flying out there. So I just want you to be aware that it's happening. We'll see where this story goes. It's a strange one. I'm not sure what to make of it, but I wanted you to be aware of it. All right. Speaking of flying, as we finish up here, I wanted to share this with you. You know, the astronauts that are stuck in space, you know, where you're like, wow, you know, I know what it's like to be delayed at the airport. Imagine you go up in space and you're like, we're going to be here for 8 days. Oh, just kidding. Several months because our ride from Boeing doesn't look safe to return to Earth. We know that the Boeing spacecraft did return. It was fine, but NASA decided not to take the risk of putting these astronauts back in the spacecraft. So they actually did an interview. It's Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams, and they're speaking in space, and you can't help but love these people because their hair's flying because there's no gravity, and they're having like this total normal conversation even though they're in outer space. It's pretty amazing. They were asked, you know, how does it feel that this is something so unpredictable happens? You know, if it was me, I'd have all sorts of emotions, but listen to how they handle a couple of these questions about how they feel about being quote unquote stranded in space.
I think the up part is we're here with our friends. We've got a ride home and you know, we're looking forward to the next couple months and doing a lot of stuff for the International Space Station.
I sent down my request for a ballot today, as a matter of fact, and they should get it to us in a couple of weeks. And absolutely, yes, it's a very important role that we all play as citizens is to be included in those elections, and NASA makes it very easy for us to do that. So we're excited about that opportunity.
And Marcia, same here. You know, it's a very important duty that we have as citizens, and looking forward to being able to vote from space, which is pretty cool. You asked what we miss, right? Of course, you know, the things that we always miss, our families. I miss my two dogs. I miss my friends. But you know what? Like Butch said, there are so many people on Earth that are sending us messages, and it makes you feel just right at home with everybody when we're able to have those conversations with our friends and family at home. So I know they understand. I know it's tough on them as well as, you know, being away from home, of course. But everybody understands, and everybody's cheering for us to get back with Crew 9.
One of the astronauts was asked, you know, do you feel like kind of like let down by Boeing? And Butch was like, not, it didn't even cross my mind. I was like, these people are, we knew that astronauts are special, but I was like, they are way better than we ever thought, because they're like, sure, we miss people, but we're just going to get some work done while we're up here. It's going to be totally fine. Like, we're good. You know, we're just going to go with the flow. I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. And a good lesson on voting. This is true, by the way. NASA astronauts do participate in elections. They do have a process for that. And it's pretty cool to hear about it, that there's already some thought about it, even though there was not the expectation they were actually going to be in space for the election. So if you're feeling like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it this year to the ballot box, you know, I'm not sure, things could get a little crazy, I just want you to think of these two that are in space unexpectedly and stuck and still finding a way to vote. So it's a great motivation for the rest of us. And I just thought I would leave you with that. You know, just go with the flow. Like, we got some work. It'll be all right. Like, we got a ride. We'll be fine. I need to take like a little teaspoon of that and like add it to my life when you're just worried that, you know, you're running behind at the dentist. You know what I mean? So a little positivity, a sprinkle of positivity to end your day today. Thanks for joining us on Scoop. I know we have a lot of stories that we don't have a lot of closure on. And I love being able to tell a story beginning to end, who, what, where, when, how, and why, and then to hand it to you. We're in this period of time where these stories are very much developing. If we see some really significant developments, we'll hop back on. And we'll make sure that gets on your radar as well. Right now, we're going to have to be in this waiting period for a few of them. And it allows us to do some more reporting and pull out some more threads of the story that could actually be of interest and teach us something instead of some of the back and forth during this time that seems a little empty. So more as we get it. Thanks for your support of Smarter News, quick, concise, nonpartisan news, and always more on smarternews.com. Keep your questions coming. Voice memos are great. We love hearing from you. We love seeing you. And we're so grateful to be together during this time. Have a great day, you guys. I'll see you soon. Bye. Thank you for believing in quick, concise, nonpartisan, smarter news. Every time you join us or share or save our content, you help us build a solution in news. And we are so grateful. We have a few other ways you can support our mission, from joining our insider community Scoop, to shopping our gear at our Smarter Shop, to just telling a friend. The best way to do any of this is to visit smarternews.com or follow us at Smarter News on social media. Don't worry, we put all of this in the captions so it's easy for you. Plus, we added our email just in case you want to drop us a note. We always love hearing from you. Thank you for helping us deliver news smarter.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.